This is Rick Watson. We are here at Shoptoberfest 2025, hosted by Shopware. We're sitting here. I'm sitting here with Matt Harris in a German beer hall. There'll be pictures, but you can just imagine. The picture is better in your mind. I'm here with the CEO and founder, Matt Harris of Harris Digital. And we're going to be talking about the state of B2B and really the difference between hard and easy commerce, what some of the companies that have been sort of left behind in commerce, like obviously everyone's apparel and like all the stuff that people talk about, it's kind of been done. But the companies that haven't done it yet, there's a reason.
That's right.
And it's not simple, is it?
No, it's not simple. And there's a lot of friction, and there's sometimes resistance, and there's a lot of complexities and I would say tech debt. So there's a lot of stuff that isn't, you know, still a lot of analog mindsets and analog reality, not just spreadsheets, but data that's, you know, in somebody's drawer, literally, like physical, you know.
It's in a huge catalog with thousands of pages in it.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the type of work we're doing, and we think that there's a ton of work in that area.
Got it. So tell me a little bit about your background. Mm-hmm. How did you get into this crazy space we call e-com, B2B? What inspired you to found the business?
Yeah, so if you want to go way back, I moved to New York City in 1995, and I was fresh out of art school, and I got a job as an animator, and we were digitizing animation.
Animator, e-commerce technology, those things go, it's like peanut butter and jelly.
Totally, it's like logical path. I was working for a company in New York called Radical Media. We did an animated ad for Nike, and that was over, and I said, hey, I just moved here and I need more work. What do you have? And they said, do you know HTML? And this was 95.
This is a lot of people's stories.
So I was like, give me a minute. So I went and taught myself, came back, they tested me, and they said, hey, you want to start, you know, we're opening up this new digital department. And then the next thing you know, in 1996, I was at the Atlantic Olympic Games in Atlanta, building a virtual waiter for IBM, where we had a you know, laptops, and you could order, there were videos, and you could order your food on the laptop and somebody physically would bring it out. And, you know, it seemed way ahead of its time. Yeah. Now it seems like nothing to do things, but that was in 96.
In 96, that's crazy.
That was crazy. So in my first e-commerce project was Gateway Computers in 1998. Huh? And
the cow boxes. I remember them.
So they were kind of.
Was it like Montana or someplace?
Yeah, South Dakota. Yeah, and then they moved to San Diego. And I was there during that time period when they were moving, and they were in a competition with Dell. So they were fighting it out.
Yeah.
So our first e-commerce engine was taking a database of products, product SKUs, product attributes, writing some Perl scripts. Mm-hmm. And creating a website that was just a series of flat files. And then there'd be some kind of call that would send an order through. So there was no live connection of a database. Mm-hmm. There were no platforms at that point. And then I just got going. At about 2000, I started up my own agency. So
that's great.
I kind of got in. I figured out there was a lot of work to be done. And I took going to grad school for architecture off the table because I was already making decent money.
Right.
So that's how it happened. And by the way, you know, back in those days in the 90s in New York, a lot of people in the web space were like math majors, philosophy majors, musicians. A lot of the hardcore engineers were like, I don't know if this is going to work. I'd rather, you know, stick with the COBOL and machine code.
Right.
It was a lot of a kind of, you know, us kind of vagabonding around creative types that were like really good at tinkering with things and solving problems. And that was the culture I fell into. And I immediately felt at home. And we were just solving problems as they came in. And it honestly, it hasn't changed in 30 years.
Right.
Same.
Yeah. At the end of the day, client wants some problem solved. And let's start at the beginning. Like, why does the client come to you?
Well, you know, honestly, it's because of the work we've already done. It's referrals. That's what's super helpful about being in the industry for so long. You kind of have a known, you know, brand, and we're in Connecticut, so a lot of our clients are in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So if a new deal comes to us, or someone hears about us, we can
what
say,
what problem are they trying to solve, you think?
Usually they're trying to sell online and they haven't already. So mm-hmm. we work with a lot of manufacturers, and the idea of selling direct, they worry about distribution, about the distribution relationships.
Yeah.
They worry about
all their existing customers.
Yeah, they're putting the sales teams at risk, and what are, you know, so there's a lot of hand-holding, like, well, this is the way the industry's going, and we're not really replacing your sales department. We're enabling your sales department to sell more. That's usually the problem.
Got it. And why don't they just do it themselves?
They try.
I know it's a ridiculous question.
Yeah, they usually come to me. The best clients are the ones that have tried and failed.
100%.
And then they come to me, and then they're like, okay. Yeah, so we had one of our...
We need a real expert.
That's right.
This is what we called Matt.
That's right. Yeah, one of our best clients came to us after trying for 3 years.
Okay.
And then they said, well, we couldn't get it live. We have this old Great Plains ERP system, and we need to, you know, feed the orders into this system. And 3 years later, we haven't figured it out. Can you figure this out? And I'm like, yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
So, you know, it took a year, but we got it up and running. And that's been it.
So you're mentioning Great Plains, which is like... I guess the ERP system that Microsoft part of one turned into Dynamics, or
yeah.
I think that's the tree is
ironically, it's like they also came from South Dakota, I believe. So Great Plains started in South Dakota.
All right. Gateway.
You know, so connecting the dots.
Right.
And they, just like Navision, Microsoft bought them.
Yeah.
And then they just kind of folded that customer base into their, you know, Dynamics.
Yeah. What's Dynamics today? And so we've mentioned ERPs a few times, and I think as we were kind of getting introduced, you were talking about kind of the complexity mm-hmm. of solving that connection to the ERP system. What, like, let's break it down just simply from the audience. Like, why do these manufacturers use an ERP system to begin with?
Yeah, well, some of them are using them on the factory floor. So, you know, you've got a bill of materials coming in. So you have a lot of little components that you're assembling into a final product. Each one of those data points needs to be tracked. Mm. And then you need to measure the value of that process. So not just materials, but time. So that, you know, the resource planning is essentially, these are the resources we have. We're assembling them into a final product. That final product's going out the door. We have to ship it. We have to track the shipping costs. And then all this feeds back into really a master accounting system mm-hmm. and bookkeeping system. So that's the core of ERP. And there were basically two origin stories. One, you know, came from manufacturing, and there's another origin story that came from like finance. Mm. So we talk about it generically as enterprise resource management, but mm-hmm. you know, these were people solving problems back in the 80s, and those systems are still with us.
Right.
And a lot of people don't know that, too. There's a lot of back office systems that are 40 years old that are still running right. these manufacturing costs.
Exactly. And so a lot of people, I mean, their business truth is in these systems. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, if you're going to talk about anything digital, mm-hmm. we're not talking about replacement.
No.
We're talking about augmenting. So like,
right.
talk to me like how you approach those conversations.
Well, we have to do a discovery. So there's an assessment. And so you have to look at what are the options for connecting into this on-premise system, let's say. And a lot of times there's something out there. There's a company that's already figured it out. Mm. So we can bring that partner in, but it starts with a discovery. And then you have to get into a data assessment. So it's one thing to have the product data in an ERP and the salespeople know what that product is and they know what the prices are. But if you're going to sell it online, you need to get all right. So there's.
But usually the data isn't all in there.
No. That's,
and so where is the data?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's in an Excel file.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in a few different.
Is it on a particular person's laptop?
So the sales department will have their Excel file with the stuff they need. The engineering will have their Excel file with the stuff. And sometimes those, you know, they're not merged. So you kind of go scrambling around finding the data.
Got it.
Yeah.
And so that's not in the ERP system because it's too hard.
It's too hard. They don't want to spend the time putting it in there. And sometimes it bloats the ERP.
Salespeople don't like to use software, period.
No. No. And operations people don't want the salespeople in their ERP. They're like, you know, so we want to be able to create a firewall.
Exactly. And so you mentioned like, look, online commerce needs discoverable products.
Mm-hmm.
That's the core of it.
Right.
Without information, you have nothing. And so what's the first step for a lot of these companies, given the fact that your starting point is three data sources, really? An Excel file for ops, the sales file for sales, and the ERP.
Yeah.
What next?
Well, so we're big fans of PIM systems because in order to sell online, you have to do some data cleanup. And to get your product data into a PIM, it's going to force you to find out where those gaps are.
Right.
So you do your data assessment as you're loading a PIM. That's a good starting point. And then once the PIM is... And a good PIM will give you a quality score.
Right, yeah.
So you're looking towards a quality score. And once that quality score threshold is met, it might not be 100%, but you're close enough. Then you're like, okay, now we can put an e-commerce ad on this.
Right.
Then you look at the rules that are applied in the ERP, and then you have to connect order flow to the ERP. And, you know, in B2B, they're not selling the same way. It's not standard.
Yeah.
A lot of times things come through as order requests. There's no credit card, you know, so there's a lot of complications. And then there's price book matching and all that stuff, which logic's usually in the ERP that they have done that.
The pricing.
Yeah. So you have to map to that price.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're talking about already a complex situation where even just for payments, like breakdown, as you mentioned, a lot of it's not credit card.
Right.
Because you're talking about big purchases, you're talking about long-standing customer relationships.
That's right.
If you had to break down, like start at 100%, how would you break down the average manufacturer you run across in terms of the payment? Like, how do they transact?
Right. So a lot of it is an order request. And, you know, you can map the price on the order request based on the pricing rules, which I could get into. But then there's also an additional shipping and handling cost that's not standard. So there's shipping freight or LTL. So, and those, and particularly in the last year or two, those rates fluctuate dramatically. So, and their margins are thin. So they can't just give away shipping fees like a normal retailer might be able to, because they padded the cost to cover for the shipping.
Yeah.
So you have to put the order request through, and then a customer support person processes that order, gets back to the buyer and says, okay, it's going to be $200 for freight. They agree to that. And then you've, you know, in a perfect system.
Yeah, so they gave a quote.
Right. So it might be a PO. So they're already in the system. So they're like, no, okay, hit the PO with this. And then they'll do an ACH transaction or something. Or you can create a card on file with a token. That's for an order request. Sometimes they're looking for a custom product. So they're like, okay.
It's like a build to order situation.
Like we need a sensor, but the sensor has to go into this. So they're selling to potential, you know, original equipment OEMs. And so there's a new product because they're coming out with this new OEM product and a sensor engineering has to slightly change. So they're putting in a request to see if they can produce these for you. So that's another type of order flow. And a lot of times that removes a piece that the salesperson might have done. That gets to another sales enabling piece. Well, let me get back to pricing, because that's where a lot of the complexity is.
Okay.
Imagine that you have standard pricing, you have tiered pricing, quantity pricing, and then you have SKU discounts per customer, and then you have trade discounts that are applied to the cart over the top. So if you have... I can't do the math fast enough, but if you have 1,000 customers and 100,000 SKUs, you have the potential to have a variation on price for every single customer on every single SKU. And, you know, that's hard to do on a standard e-commerce build. You have to think through. So you have to build a connector and a pricing engine, and you have to map to a price.
Got it. It makes sense. I mean, look, a lot of these are relationship-based businesses. Where the founder and the sales team has had been working with these accounts for decades, as you mentioned. What are the different types of customer segments that your manufacturing customers have? Like between like national accounts, regional accounts, like onesie, twosie, like how would they classify their types of customers?
Yeah, so a lot of them are working with OEMs, and those would be tier one. So like your you're putting something into a Maytag dishwasher or something like that. They've been making those parts for them forever, and there's usually a salesperson who's managing that relationship. Mm-hmm. And usually, unless it's a replacement part, so let's say those Maytag dishwashers get out there and the sensor that you built breaks, and there's a repairman that comes in and they want to source that product. That's when the e-commerce engine becomes really helpful. Because that manufacturer...
Parts and service, reorders.
Reorders. And then there's the smaller regional manufacturers who are also buying from other manufacturers. So they're doing an assembly of something, and it might be a boutique assembly. Mm. And so there'll be sales teams that are going and trying to help these customers, but the payoff isn't as high as the tier one or the big major OEM. That's also where the e-commerce platform could come into play. So you can take the product offerings you have, find people that might be searching for those, which they were invisible before.
Right.
And then there might be a little thing that says, are you interested in this? It doesn't even have to be transaction. It's not even like a credit card. It's like a contact to us if you want a part like this. So it becomes another arm of the sales department. It's sales enablement, really. And what it does is it gets the reach of the sales team beyond where they can physically go. So they're going to hit the big markets, you know, boots on the ground, and there's still, it's kind of that.
Yeah.
But it just expands the reach. And then the sales teams can focus on kind of higher value sales efforts.
Got it. And now talk to me a little bit about the pricing component, because you said, you know, obviously that can get super complex.
Mm-hmm.
Different assemblies for different customers, for different volumes, for different products, mm-hmm. for different regions even.
Right.
Different areas of the country, international. Mm. Does the ERP system really solve that problem for a lot of these customers? Or are there other software that people bring in for that?
There's sometimes other software that they bring in. They'll have the ERP do the inventory and the accounting piece, but they'll have another pricing engine.
Okay.
So that comes into play a lot in wholesale businesses, because wholesale is very price conscious, and they have their own suppliers. And like if you're getting raw materials in and there's tariffs going on, the price of steel might fluctuate dramatically. So you're selling nails with the right hand selling nails and the left hand's bringing in raw steel.
Right.
And all of a sudden the price of your nails went up, but the sales department doesn't know it. So there's actually sales engines that have dynamic pricing calculators that are based on that day's cost of raw materials.
Got it. So, I mean, obviously clients have a lot of needs when they come to you. I mean, they're dealing with this complex software. They're dealing with the human problem of adoption, like sales. You hinted at it a couple of times, even in our brief conversation so far, like salespeople may not want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Customers may not want to use it. Right. Salespeople, you know, sales managers might be threatened by it. What types of problems do you guys lean into? And what types of problems do you guys say, actually, this is what you need to solve? Well, we can't be equipped to solve this for you.
Sometimes the data is such a mess and we can't get into their office physically that you have to give them some pointers on helping out. But we're pretty proactive about trying to help. And our philosophy is to kind of land and grow, you know, solve a problem.
Right.
And then, you know, explain that there's other things that we can continue to help with. But we don't, there's some platforms that we bring in partners on that we don't do, but we know like kind of our ICP, there's a few pieces that they're going to use. We do a lot of NetSuite work. So, you know, if they have the appetite to get off that old on-prem system, onto a new modern cloud system, a lot of times NetSuite's a good solution.
Yeah.
And we'd work with depending on the size of the project, we'd bring in an alliance partner from NetSuite to do that build. But then we would go and pivot over to do the support and maintenance, because we're certified as well, depending on the size. Small business, we can do it. Large businesses, that could be a 2-year project.
Yeah. And if you were to break down like the percentage of the big buckets in the projects you talked about, obviously you mentioned sort of assessment, discovery, planning. Which parts are like, actually, we need to fix your ERP and your PIM versus the e-com, like search and discovery and quoting side of it? Like, how would you break down those major buckets?
I would look at so we do a gap analysis and we look at risks and appetite for rules. So this is where we want to be with this company in 5 years. This is where you are now. Where's your appetite for risk? What is something that you can take on? So the biggest one is always ERP. So it's like we usually kind of navigate around that. And I think the industry is starting to get wise on this. Like,
Explain what you mean by that.
So, you know, an e-commerce agency that's been working in, let's say, a modern SaaS platform.
Yeah.
They oftentimes think everything is easy or should be easy. So they're kind of a marketing agency that can add an e-commerce site up and drive leads.
Assuming all the data's clean and
the
angels are singing and everything.
So a lot of times, like during the COVID, when you had this huge spike in e-commerce growth because people are trying to sell online, they would come in and say, well, you know, this ERP, you have to replace them. And then you saw the data come out, which was like 65 to 70% of the ERP replatformings failed.
Yeah.
And because it's really hard.
It's just any enterprise software.
Yeah,
project.
You don't want to do it.
It's going to fail.
Right. That's right.
Not like six times out of 10.
Right. So it's like, okay, don't start there. That could be on the roadmap though.
Right.
So what we look at is there a way to connect into this so we can get order flow? There might even be some manual steps initially. Mm-hmm. Let's get the data clean. Let's get a website up. We might, let's not even put all the products up there. Let's start with like 100 products.
Yeah.
So it's those small incremental wins where you're demonstrating value, the customer sees the effort, and you know there's always a backlog of work at that point because you've already discussed that during this discovery. We're not doing this yet. Here's why. We're not doing this yet. Here's why.
Yeah. And you mentioned during your kind of talk so far, kind of your ICP or your ideal customer profile, like for Harris Digital, who is that?
So I would say a regional manufacturer distributor that's in what we describe as mid-market, which in America goes up to $1 billion. Mm-hmm. So below $1 billion.
Yeah.
And probably...
By the way, that's the correct version of mid-market, I think.
You think so?
So many people say, it was like, oh, mid-market up to 200 million. I'm like...
Yeah.
So where's enterprise?
Enterprise, I know.
Doesn't make sense.
In Europe, their numbers are different. So,
yes, correct.
So, but in America, 1 billion. Not that we wouldn't work. We have actually a couple clients, but our ICP is where we think we can deliver the most value and a lot of value. And then down to...
There are huge firms above $1 billion that can do a lot of things.
Right. And then we'll go to the small side, which is, you know, companies doing... we can do small projects for companies doing 5 million, really. Yep. They want a simple thing. But that's our ICP, manufacturers and distributors in that space. So and we do a lot of trades materials, so like construction materials, plumbing, HVAC, that kind of thing. Those are often regionalized industries because you don't want to ship across state lines necessarily. So it's kind of a hub and spoke model where you might be warehousing something somewhere and then you're going to put it on your own truck. So you're going to ship it out and you're not going to drive 200 miles with your truck. So a lot of distribution is built that way in the trades. It's regional.
That's an interesting set of customers because... It seems like that those types of companies, you know, very profitable.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times are family businesses. And then it just kind of feels to me that private equity has started getting involved in a lot of those sorts of businesses. Mm-hmm. What do you think are the forces that are shaping your ideal customers right now? Like, what's motivating them? What's affecting them? Like, I know obviously in direct to consumer and other things and everywhere it's like tariffs, but consolidation or like the big forces.
So the big forces are, the one big force is generational mindsets.
Hmm.
So you've got a baby boomer generation that's aging out.
Got it.
Who has built, or let's just say continued on with a very successful company for 30 or 40 years. And in their minds, it's not broke.
Usually passed down from family or something.
So you have a millennial coming in who hasn't quite got the range yet, but they're digitally native and they see all this.
Mom and dad have all the relationships and with the top customers.
That's right. Totally. And you know, the millennial's in there like just waiting to get the reins, be like, oh, I can't believe we're still doing it this way. Right. So there's a lot of friction there. And then I think there's a lot of, you know, next generation family members that just don't want it. They don't want to get into it. It's not part of their world. So you're going to see also a lot of consolidation. You're going to see private equity is already getting in. You know, we've seen that firsthand. So private equity wants to kind of bundle these up and scale. Yeah. So I think we're seeing a lot of disruption there. And then there'll be, I think with AI and the coming of, is the next wave of technological revolution, just like we saw in the 90s, I think you're going to see a lot of businesses decide to kind of not keep up, even though maybe they could. So that's where we come in. That's my job is to help those businesses not just die off or sell for a low price because they haven't modernized.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned AI, which is like the buzzword of the year, I think, right? So we have to talk about it a little bit. You were mentioning in some of the prep, the article that's going around 95% of projects, AI projects aren't delivering revenue. I was listening to the Walmart earnings call about 3 weeks ago. The CEO said, yeah, we're using AI and it's helping us be more efficient, but we can't track its influence on revenue yet.
Right.
And so I would love for you to talk a little bit about what you view as the state of AI now, not the hype, but like what's happening on the ground.
So I think the small scale AI is really effective. So personal use, personal assistant. And then there's also analytics and machine learning on the enterprise, but those two things aren't connected yet. So if imagine that you have 200 people using AI in your business to help them perform their job. Imagine if all those agents could talk to all the other agents and then there was a master brain receiving those signals and looking for ways to modernize the entire organization dynamically. That's, I think, the future state of where AI is going to really propel businesses forward. Every person interacting in that business has a digital signature and an agent that's feeding into kind of a master brain. That disconnect is...
It sounds like more data they don't have.
Like more siloed data.
Typically they don't have.
Right. So the current state of AI is we're creating more siloed data.
Right.
That's right. Total. And lots of it. Right. Lots and lots of it. Yeah. So I think that gap, and this is what came out in that AI paper. They were basically in the MIT paper about AI. They said 95% of the enterprise projects are failing and not showing revenue. But they didn't go as far to say, and they won't.
Uh-huh.
They're just, right. they're two years in.
Started 5 minutes ago.
Right.
People.
Totally.
Like, 100%. Have some patience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see this as a two-year project. I see this as probably a 10 to 20-year project.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're in it for the long haul. Of course, we use AI. We're telling our clients, get all your data in one spot and keep feeding it into this spot. Just get your data lake up.
Where is that? So it's not your ERP. We already figured that out.
It's a separate system.
It works for some data, not others. The e-com.
Yeah.
It's the presentation.
Right.
Especially in B2B, it's mostly the presentation. Right. It's not the source of truth. Where data lake, define what that is.
So data lake is essentially like a big file system where you could just dump any kind of data.
Yeah.
So you could dump data from 5 different systems. And it just sits in there. It's just floating in your data lake. And then you build a translation tool, and then you build a data warehouse. The data warehouse is structured for your business, the way you want to see your data. And then you take all those different data sources and you write a translation tool to push them into your data warehouse. Then you model the data so that you can visualize it. And now you're seeing data coming in from marketing and from sales, and from your e-commerce site, and from your ERP, and your order, and your shipment, and customer retention. It's all in a single system.
It just sounds like a 10-year journey.
Totally. Totally. But to me, it's like, that's the beginning.
Yeah.
Once you have that all in one system and it's structured, now you can use machine learning and AI to make a smarter business. But as long as the data is all...
Everyone's trying to shortcut it.
No, right. And they think, AI is just going to do this for us.
Yeah, we're going to AI it.
Yeah. Totally. I know. It's fun. I kind of want, personally, the AI hype. I want the AI bubble to burst.
Right.
So that we can get to the other side. Like, I feel
like... this happened in e-commerce back in 99. Like, especially for folks like you and I had been in e-com for a long time. We went through the bubble, and then we had to build back. And then we had another bubble.
That's right.
In COVID and
Yeah.
It burst again.
Irrational exuberance.
We haven't burst.
Remember that
AI
phrase?
Exactly.
Totally. Yep. That's where we are. And it's like, it's not that it isn't real. It's not that it isn't transformative. It's not that it isn't going to change everything. But is the market value of all these investments that we're making right now actually merit that level of investment? There's going to be a lot of losers.
Yeah.
There's going to be some huge winners. But I think I want to get to the other side.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of hype and some snake oil salesmen out there trying to claim they got this.
Everyone's an agentic expert, Matt. So, come on.
Why aren't you using these tools yet?
Right.
You're falling behind.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, look, you're in it for the long haul,
mm-hmm.
and I think your track record speaks for itself. Tell me, if someone wants to find out more about Harris Digital, how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah.
If they were going to work with you, what would be the first step of working with you?
Yeah, just contact us on our website, harrisdigital.io. There's a form right there. Call the number.
What, you have a phone?
Yeah, we have a phone.
Is it answered by a robot?
Yes, of course. Yeah. Our agent will get back to you. Our AI agent will get right back to you really fast.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how you find us. We're all over LinkedIn. I've got my own podcast called Verado where we talk about tech.
That's great.
It's MIT report. Nanda, I don't know if you've looked into Nanda. It was out of the MIT department called Nanda, which is a really interesting organization. It's kind of like DNS for agents.
Mm-hmm.
That's the theory.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I read something about that recently.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems super fascinating, but I haven't dug that deep into it, but I like that it's open source too. So it's like open source, internet-based, agent communication portal, like a DNS system.
Got it.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So we started with like green screens and catalogs mm-hmm. and ERP, and now we're ending with like the future.
That's right.
Agents, so wide-ranging conversations. Really appreciated, Matt.
Yeah,
thanks a lot for spending time.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right, thanks again.